This episode is brought to you by the Sexton Single Malt Irish Whiskey, the best-selling Irish single malt in the U.S. The Sexton is an unexpected modern malt for the everyman, rich in hue, approachable in taste, and memorable in character. Learn more at thesexton.com.
I'm HRN's Executive Director, Katie Mosman-Wadler, with a preview of this week's episode of Meat and Three, HRN's weekly food news roundup. This week, we're celebrating Pride. We speak to the bakers who created a custom wedding cake for Charlie Craig and David Mullins, the couple behind the Masterpiece Cake Shop Supreme Court case.
We felt that what happened to Charlie and David was an absolute injustice.
Kat Johnson addresses the controversy surrounding Anthony Porosky, Queer Eye's food and wine expert.
Many viewers thought these recipes were unsophisticated.
And finally, Hannah Forden speaks with nutrition educator Leah Kurtz about the relationship between veganism and queer identity.
It's an interesting way in which food can challenge invisible value systems even greater than sexuality does.
Listen to Meat and Three, that's M-E-A-T plus sign T-H-R-E-E, this week, and celebrate Pride with HRN. Available on Stitcher, Apple Podcasts, and your favorite listening apps.
You've heard of jalopies, you've heard the noise they make, but let me introduce my new Rocket 88. Yes, it's straight, just one.
All right, you're listening to the Main Course OG. I am one of your hosts, Patrick Martins. It's June 14th. That was Rocket 88, credited as the first ever rock and roll song ever recorded. We, in turn, are the first ever show to record on Heritage Radio Network back in 2009. And that was the first song ever played on Heritage Radio Network. That song was the first sound ever. So we are very excited today, not only because it's Flag Day, but also because the largest Woo-hoo! Event in the world is about to start today, the World Cup. So...
Go USA.
Mexico and Germany play today. I think Russia's in the first game, but most important, and this is for Vitor Hersh.
This is golf, right? The World Cup is golf?
Golf, yes. It's golf, but with no club. Wait a second. What's that horn? I want to hear the... What's that horn they play at World Cup games? It's called like a kazoo or something.
The vuvuzela.
What's it called?
I think vuvuzela.
Vuvuzela. I want to hear if you can pull up a vuvuzela.
Vitor was all over that.
Vitor is from Brazil. My family's from Brazil. Brazil plays Switzerland this Saturday, so we're very excited. Brazil is everyone's either favorite country or second favorite country. No one hates Brazil, except maybe Argentina, but we're very excited about that. I'm in studio today with Emily Pearson, who's our point guard today, Catherine Greeley, the vice president of Heritage Foods USA, Mike Edison, author of I Have Fun Everywhere I Go, former editor of High Times, Brandon Hoy, visionary and founder of Roberta's and opening restaurants around the world, me, Patrick, and we have two very special guests, Frank Reese of the Good Shepherd Institute and Daniel Sharp, the chef and visionary behind the 6, soon to be 7 meatball shops, one of the most interesting restaurant concepts ever. So without further ado, I'll throw it to Emily Pearson to tell us what we're talking about today.
Thanks, Patrick. Good morning, everyone. Today we're going to be talking about pot, Dennis Rodman, North Korea, topsoil, the film Eating Animals, and meatballs, of course.
Is that North Korean topsoil?
Maybe.
Only Korean North.
I'm going to have to pull up a stat really fast about that, but yes. We also have a pop question for our crew, and as always, we don't tell our panelists the exact details of each topic, so we'll see how everyone performs this morning. To start, we'll get everyone into our segment, The Weekly Base. Our first article is from The Verge. The North Korean summit this week with U.S. President Donald Trump and North Korean leader Kim Jong-un had an extra visitor hyping up a marijuana-focused cryptocurrency. Retired pro basketball player Dennis Rodman arrived in Singapore on Monday, June 11th, wearing a T-shirt to rep the virtual currency Potcoin. Potcoin was released through GitHub in 2014 by three entrepreneurs in Montreal. Its trade volume over the last 24 hours has reached $1.1 million. But it's not the only coin dedicated to marijuana. There's also Dopecoin, Hempcoin, Cannabis Coin, and a host of other smaller cryptos. Mike, what coin are you trading your pot on these days?
Well, I eat Potcoin. I'm mistaken for an edible. So I've been eating them with no tangible result, unfortunately.
That sound effect was actually Mike's stomach.
I thought it was like one of those coins you get at Hanukkah, you know, the chocolate gelt. I don't really understand the whole cryptocurrency thing. I'm not ashamed to say that I don't really understand blockchain entirely. I do get it's a peer-to-peer digital currency. It's supposed to keep you off the grid. But honestly, like I give my popular cash, so I don't really know what the point of having a cryptocurrency is for my drug dealer for something that's basically, it's borderline legal now. We're moving towards it. But in my house, I keep cash, and I also keep gold because I don't know what Potcoin is going to do for me. Like, when the apocalypse really comes and I need some money to get on the spaceship to escape, I think, like, my Krugerrand is going to go a lot farther than any Bitcoin.
Mike and I actually share a hiding space for our loot, which is kind of odd because it makes it very difficult to know whose is whose. So I'm sure when we have to get on that spaceship, there's going to be some some backstabbing, right? Yeah. Like I'm sure you also have like a straight blade hidden somewhere to like make sure that I don't steal all your loot, right?
I keep it next to the bong where it should be.
Well, I think Dennis Rodman should be thought of, considered for Secretary of State. He's a great rebounder. He's emotional, kind of. He wears his emotions on his sleeve, you know. So, I mean, you want a good communicator, someone who's not afraid to cry. He gets along with world leaders. He might get them stoned, which should make them more peaceful.
Was he the worm?
Yeah, he was the worm. Yeah, and he's a great coalition builder. He gets all these former NBA players like Kenny Anderson and all that to travel around the world.
I bet
for
he
peace.
Knows a lot about topsoil.
Do you think? That's
the
a big
worm?
Card. That's true. That's true. Well, what do you think, Catherine? What do you think? Do you trade in Choco currency or crypto? Pot currency?
I have not gotten into pot currency yet, no. But I will say it was interesting to me. We've come a long way. It was since the Silk Road, the first modern darknet market, where you could buy illegal drugs using Bitcoin.
They threw that guy away for a long time, boy. They threw the book at him.
But now
the Silk Road dude.
But now they're advertising it with, the president.
Well, you know, the thing about pot is it's going to become legal. It's virtually legal now, and state by state, it's turning that way. Even the president went against the DOJ by saying we're going to let the states decide. There's just too much money involved in it, and the Colorado model works, and the states in the Pacific Northwest and California who are selling weed recreationally, it's going to turn very quickly. There's a porn coin too.
Oh, really?
Which is kind of a big thing. You should try pork coin. I recommend
pork coin.
Yeah, pork coin.
Do you this need is our special for, guest, Daniel Sharp.
Do you need a coin for everything you need to buy out there? Is that what it's moving to? It's like every coin is going to be specific to what you need?
I actually think people should be valued by coins, like how good they are in the world. So I would have high value because I trade in rare
breeds. So kind of like Mario
breeds.
Kart, right? Mm-hmm. Like the faster you go, the more coins you get. Isn't that how Mario Kart works?
Yes. And you say I have a human value of X amount because I do really good. Whereas Goldman Sachs people would rate very high on money, but very low on what are they actually doing
moral.
To help the world. Yeah, moral. I'd like a moral currency to go. Catherine, you would be very high. Mike?
Basically, you want to be God, in other words.
No, I wouldn't be the one to administer it. There would need to be a committee.
Mike Edison would be very high, too.
But at some point, you got to cash this in, so what do you get?
What do you get?
Copy of the home game and some luggage.
Respect.
Dennis Rodman.
You're
esteemed. You just get Dennis Rodman. That's
just
all we're
Rodman.
I do like that Dennis Rodman is playing a major role in one of the tensest zones in the world. I think that's great.
No, and believe it or not, he finds himself to be a key player in this and
he
really
is.
Believes it. I mean, in the article, it talks about the fact that he thinks he should be in the top three picked for the next Nobel Peace Prize.
Actually don't disagree. I mean, and plus, what a great guy to have. He's a happy, fun guy who's friends with all these NBA players. I'd much rather him than who is the Secretary of State now.
And also a crazy drug addict, which is totally... Mm-hmm.
He's definitely spent a lot of time in North Korea, and I think that's because they let him do some real bad things.
Oh, really? I see.
What else is the appeal? Like, you're like, oh, okay. They, Dennis Rodman, they roll out the red carpet, and they're like, You're freaking. What do you like?
I think Brandon should be nominated. I want to nominate Brandon. But really, all I'm saying is give pizza a chance.
Give pizza a chance.
Thank you. Thank you for that. So our next story is out of New York and Berkeley via Instagram. Alice Waters posted a wonderful Instagram the other day. She wrote about an event last Friday and said, "We had a party at Panisse for Frank Reese, a remarkable heritage breed poultry rancher from Kansas. Our chefs cooked his duck, turkey, and chicken. Amazing. I have always focused on sustainability, and I forgot all about breed. What a difference in taste. And Heritage Foods sells his birds."
She also went on to say, if you remember, that she literally said this, and we have witnesses. She said, "Our job at Chez Panisse is to deliver the best ingredients to our customers, and we have not been doing that for poultry because we have not been serving Frank's birds. His birds are the best." She said that to the whole crowd. I mean, higher compliment than that, it really doesn't exist.
No, it was fantastic to hear her say that. I just forgot to hit record, was all. Anyway, Frank Reese himself is in town as we speak, promoting the New York premiere of Eating Animals at the IFC Center, and will be walking the red carpet tonight with film producer Natalie Portman and director Christopher Quinn. I believe we have Frank on the line. Frank, are you there?
I am here.
Good morning.
Good morning.
We're so happy to have you on the line. Thanks for taking a few minutes away from, I think, your press touring today a bit. Yeah. Are you having fun?
Right now I'm resting from the trip.
Good. Awesome. So first question for you is, what do you most hope this film will educate the public about from your perspective and your life work? And what would you like as the takeaway?
I think the importance of biodiversity, that to remember that the mass amount of poultry that's being raised worldwide comes out of a monoculture. And hopefully people will see in the film that my work is about saving endangered poultry and bringing back biodiversity, which also then brings back many other issues. Hopefully they'll see the contrast between my type of farming and what they call industrial or factory farming, and that poultry should be something beautiful, both externally and good for the environment as well.
Well, can you give us that line, Frank, that you sometimes say about Amish, free range, the Whole Foods birds, antibiotic free, farmer market birds? They all have something in common, right?
Well, yes. I mean, I always tell people, I don't care if you call it organic, free range, all natural, Amish raised, whatever you want to call it, there's absolutely genetically no difference between that chicken that you're buying at your local store and maybe a health food store than what is being sold from the industry, whether it's Purdue or Tyson or Pilgrim Pride or whatever. Everybody is raising the very same genetic. And I always tell people, I don't care how well you treat a zebra. You can feed it organic and love it and let it run free and feed it grass and have an all-vegetable diet. It will not become a horse. It is what it is at the moment of its conception. And so no matter how well you treat these industrial genetics, they are what they are at the moment of their conception, at the moment that they hatch. You can't change that by the environment. You can't change that by what you feed it.
Very interesting.
And the other part is you know, if you come to my farm, you will see something you'll never see at any other farm. And that's old birds, birds that get to live a full life. I have birds that actually die of old age. That's unheard of. Not only are the birds that you buy from me that for eating running free and having a wonderful, normal life, but so are the parents, the grandparents, the entire system.
So this is a vegan movie, it's been said. I mean, it's listed as a vegan movie, and yet you're a meat producer. So, I mean, what is your contribution?
It's really not a vegan movie. The thing about it is, though, a bunch of the groups that are vegans, that are animal rights people, have tried to put their stamp on this. But if you listen closely to the movie, it never tells anybody what to eat. I mean, it obviously can't be a completely vegan movie if I'm a part of it. They actually show us loading the turkeys onto the truck to go to be processed. It talks a lot about the struggles of being an independent farmer and trying to provide somebody with a better product. So it's really not a vegan movie. They do talk about alternatives. They do talk about, you know, plant-based protein. And I have nothing, there's nothing wrong with that. You know, I'm all about free choice. You can choose not to eat meat. You can choose to eat meat. But you aren't going to change 90% of the people in the world who still continue to have meat as part of their meals occasionally. Eating meat and that relationship that we have with domesticated animals goes back thousands of years. And it's infiltrated into our culture, into our religions, into our societies. And you're not going to undo that. We just need to go back to a more natural animal.
I agree with
you. It's a better system.
What we talk about here, Patrick and I have always been talking about, is not whether we should eat meat. The question whether Americans eat meat has already been answered. We do. It's how we eat it. We should be eating better meat. I think, honestly, Frank, when they let you in this movie, if you'll forgive me, I think they kind of let a fox in the hen house, at least as far as the industrial farming system goes, because it is disgusting. I personally would never buy anything that's a Purdue or Smithfield on it. It's absolutely repulsive, both the genetics and the way the chickens are raised. And what you're doing is something that, yeah, it's existed for... since the very beginning of agriculture, it works, it's clean, it's humane. It is a little bit more expensive, but it's right in line with what Patrick and Heritage Foods has always said, is we should be eating less meat, we should be eating better meat.
And actually, one interesting thing that Frank says is his genetics are actually connected to 5,000 years of agricultural history, whereas 99.9% of the meats we eat in this country and around the world actually are this artificially created, genetically modified poultry and meats that started in the 1960s.
It's disgusting.
Yeah, it's only 60 years of history.
It's so gross. I mean, yeah, it's only recent latter part of the 20th century, this sort of agriculture, this sort of industrial, commercial, military complex, basically, that produces this food. But it's horrifying, and it is gross. And if that were the only way to get meat, I would stop eating meat. Fortunately, I have an alternative.
So how can
there
we see...
There would be no chickens or turkeys in the store today if the factory farm stopped intervening. All the animals being sold are completely dependent upon their system for reproduction. Like, everything is artificial. Mm-hmm. The turkeys can no longer naturally mate. The chickens are made up of somewhere between 18 and 20 F crosses. They're a complete man-made animal that is completely dependent for their existence upon the factory farm system.
Mm-hmm. And so, Frank, to avoid all of that, you hatch all of the animals right on your farm, right?
Yes, all the farm. So, I don't buy anything from anybody.
So all of these other, where you say the Amish and all these different groups, if you buy birds from them, you're buying from the same commodity group. They're all buying from one place, right?
Yes, they're all buying. Most of them are buying everything from a company called Hubbard, which owns all the genetics in the world. I don't care if they're Freedom Rangers, Slow Growth, Red Bro, Red Rex, whatever you want to call them that a lot of these people are raising. They all come from the same system. None of those birds can reproduce themselves, and by that I mean is if you, they can still the chickens can still naturally mate. About 70% of the chickens in the world are still produced by natural mating, but it is through multiple mutation lines, and so you have to be a factory farm to be able to support that multiple system.
Well, thank you so much, Frank.
I put chickens in the backyard and let them breed. You know, you can't do that. To get those chickens to grow at an unnatural rate of 200 to 300 times faster than a normal chicken, you have to be able to maintain multiple mutated lines to be able to get that happen, which is brilliant because that's how you control the system.
Well, thanks.
That way the farmer must always go back to the feed store to get their chicken.
Frank, you have to leave everybody wanting a little more. They have to go and see the film, which is Eating Animals.
A great film.
It's a limited release coming out this Friday, June 15th, definitely in New York, and I believe out in San Francisco.
It's AMC, right? IFC?
It's IFC Films, and you can find out more information on IFC's website. There are a couple panels this weekend on Friday and Saturday with Natalie Portman and Christopher Quinn, so if you're in the New York area, check those out. They are open to the public, and tickets are available online, and then you can hopefully catch the film locally near you after that. Thanks so much, Frank.
And if Natalie asks for me, feel free to give her my cell phone number, Frank.
I will be sure and do that, Patrick. I promise.
Thank you. And we look forward to the red carpet tonight and see you in a few hours.
All right. See you all later.
I have a feeling if you met Natalie Portman, she'd go all black swan on your ass.
So let's bring up some of these issues. So veganism. What's your answer, Brandon? You got people coming to your restaurant and asking vegan, do you have vegan pizza? I mean, what is your thoughts about that movement in America?
I mean, to each his own. It's not my cup of tea, but if that's what you want to do. My biggest problem with it is just like this ridiculousness to like make meat food that's not meat, which is like if you want to be vegan, just eat vegetables. There's plenty of great things out there in the world to eat. The array of vegetables and things that you could eat if you wanted to be vegan are endless and delicious. I just don't understand this like need to like make your all your vegetables look like meat. It's like if that's what you want, just eat meat. Mm-hmm. Like figure out what why you're doing this. But it just you're creating a whole world of more processed food that just doesn't need to be there. Mm-hmm.
What do you think, Emily? I mean, what do you think of the film? I mean, honestly, I mean, we love Frank, obviously, but...
No, I actually had a similar takeaway from Frank that, you know, I know it's being billed as a somewhat vegan film, but as a consumer, you know, separate from my role with Heritage, just as a consumer, it didn't make me necessarily feel badly about my choices as an individual. It's the system and the world in which we live, and Big Ag really has the upper hand and is 99% of what we're finding out there. And it's just about educating yourself. So I don't think it's about being vegan or eating meat. It's about finding some balance and understanding where your ingredients or where your breeds come from and that you have a choice in purchasing.
Do you think this film changed minds or just reinforced what people already think?
I think it may have, I think it reinforced, but it may have gone positively for carnivores. Mm-hmm. You know, even hearing Frank speak out in Berkeley at the panel after the film screening on Friday, he won over the vegans. You know, you could feel the energy in the room. They still had their beliefs. They were proud that they had just marked one girl had just marked her 1 year anniversary of being a vegan, but his responses, his thoughtfulness about how he raises his birds definitely resonated with them. So I think it's a success for everybody. But, you know, I don't know that it's changing anyone or polarizing people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think perhaps it's giving people an additional alternative. You know, introducing Frank. Heritage breeds are one of the top trends in the National Restaurant Association this year, and you know, I think breeds are something that are people are becoming more aware of.
He was the most interesting part of the film. I mean, eat them to save them, they're endangered breeds, you know, you can still eat meat and not feel bad about yourself, you know, not everything is right. I mean, yeah, I thought Frank was a really interesting part of the film.
Well, we hope everyone will go and see it, and then you can have your own thoughts and agree or disagree with us. We have one more article very quickly before our break. This was from the Scientific American. It's being reported that there are only 60 years of topsoil left. Generating 3 centimeters of topsoil takes 1,000 years, and we just can't keep up. Supposedly, intensive farming is to blame. What do you guys think?
Damn it, agriculture.
I think we just got to get Dennis Rodman in on this problem.
Get the worm in there.
So now vegetables are the problem too?
Yeah, vegetables. Well, they say that the second agriculture started, that was dangerous for the planet. And this guy, Wes Jackson, has actually started the Land Institute in Kansas, and he's basically saying agriculture is bad. and we should be eating prairie grasses that grow naturally out of the earth.
Oh my God, delicious.
Yeah, delicious.
Alice actually said on Friday, she said, the only problem is they taste terrible.
Well, kernza is what they've named their one hope to make bread out of and all that. Well, if we didn't use topsoil, we didn't rely on it at all, could we eat pizza? I'm just trying to think. I mean, yeah, right? You can still make bread without topsoil and cheese, right?
Well,
tomatoes, you need to make wheat,
right? You need to make tomatoes. I mean, I would say no, probably. It would probably be very difficult.
No,
hydroponics.
No, but substitutes.
Yeah.
Hydroponics, yeah.
I believe you can hunter-gatherer your way to a pizza, right?
Yes,
yeah,
you could.
I mean... I've read about it.
Not many pizzas, maybe like four or five.
I think there's some freegans locally that could do that.
Well, that is pretty crazy to think, what are we going to do with that thin layer of topsoil? It's like the ozone layer and the topsoil layer, these two thin little dwindling.
We just have to find a planet that's totally inhabitable, change all of our ways, move there, find a new drug, right? We definitely need a new drug.
Kicks keep getting harder to find, man. But we saw this coming. I mean, the tipping point was a long time ago. You know, in terms of the environment, we knew we've soiled the nest. We know that the ozone is depleted. We know that there is so much, particulate in the air. We know the water is dirty. The ocean is filled with plastic. I mean, this is not news. I mean, 60 years may seem like a long time, but we've known for a long time that the way American industry, industrial farming, and the petrochemical corporations, et cetera, the way this has been going, we've been fucked for a long time. And deregulating things, which seems to be the current administration, and I say the current administration, I mean Dennis Rodman,
who is
one step away from becoming Secretary of Commerce.
And winner of the Nobel Prize.
Ambassador Rodman. is to deregulate everything and let people, dump poison in the river because that's just part of doing business. And I've said it before on the show that I think anybody who dumps poison in a river should go to jail forever and ever. Unfortunately, that hasn't been the case, and here we are. So am I concerned about 60 years of topsoil? I don't know. I'd like the people in charge to be a little bit concerned as well, to kind of trickle down concern. I mean, of course I am. As a human being, I live on the planet.
Yeah, no, it's wild.
We actually we need to take a minute for a break. So hear a word from our sponsor.
I'm Souther Teague of Moria Margo and co-host of The Speakeasy on Heritage Radio Network. This episode is brought to you by the Sexton Single Malt Irish Whiskey, a new and unexpected modern malt for the everyman. The whiskey is made from 100% Irish malted barley, triple distilled for smoothness in copper pot stills, and consciously aged for 4 years in Oloroso sherry butts. My favorite part about the Sexton is that sherry influence from those Oloroso sherry butts. They're the large sherry barrels that have been used. And then the whiskey gets aged in them for 4 years, giving them this sort of nutty, almost savory quality. The copper pot still makes for extremely smooth finish. I like it in a highball or just neat. Every time I have a sip, I want another one. So next time you're gathered with friends or posted up at your favorite bar, reach for the Sexton, the best-selling Irish single malt in North America. You can learn more at thesexton.com.
Well, welcome back. Thanks for joining us. This is the Main Course OG on Heritage Radio Network, and we're coming to you live from Roberta's in Bushwick, Brooklyn. Our next segment is what we called the Maillard Reaction. We're going to throw out a pop question. So everyone, with all the talks of celebrities, red carpets, movie premieres, Dennis Rodman, if you could walk the red carpet with one celeb, who would it be?
Who would it be? That's a good question.
I'm going to go with Carol Burnett.
Really?
Yeah.
Carol Burnett. You'll be her Tim Conway?
Yeah. Exactly. Nice. Or Harvey
Korman. Well, no, I think you got more of a Tim Conway build.
I almost said Harvey Kurtzman, who was the founder of Mad Magazine. But yeah, Tim Conway, yeah.
He was very funny. Well, who do you pick? That's funny that you asked that question.
I don't know. I think I came ill prepared. Oh, no. I was excited to hear what you... I knew you were going to say Natalie Portman.
Be George Clooney so people could see how much we look alike and, accidentally mistake me for him, and then my life would be great.
Well, this is a food show. I mean, I would pick... who ate really well in history? I mean, Henry VIII, I think, is credited as the historical figure.
Orson Welles.
Orson Welles ate a lot. Who are the top five food figures in history.
The giant gourmands, you mean the Rabelaisian characters.
Caligula-type foodies.
Brando near the end, right?
He was the size of an island.
The detective Nero Wolfe, Rex Stout's character, Nero Wolfe, who was a gourmand. He was a very famous detective, but he was a gourmand. He was very famous sitting around eating. In fact, Rex Stout, the author, claimed that he had over 1,300 different recipes to prepare eggs.
Really? So
you wouldn't want to stand next to Julia Child?
That's who I was thinking of.
Yeah? That was going to be yours?
Julia Child is cool.
She would be a lot of fun, too, I think.
I think she'd be a hoot with the press. And then obviously everyone would look much shorter next to her.
Get loaded on cooking, Sherry. It'd be awesome.
I don't know. I think for me, you know, I guess if I were to segue into Bourdain a little bit, I think he's somebody who would have been really... for me, you know, I sort of fell into this food world because chefs are celebrities to me. Mm-hmm. And I think that if we're going that angle, who could I walk down the red carpet to, you know, with? Bourdain would be pretty cool.
What about the Swedish chef from the Muppets? I always liked him.
Mike, I was going somewhere serious. Come on.
I'm very serious. This is like sort of like a meatball segue.
Did you talk to Bourdain? Did you ever meet Bourdain in your travels as a chef?
No, just in passing. He's a pretty reserved guy from what I understood. But yeah. Yeah, it was amazing to see the outpouring in our industry. You know, he definitely was a hero to many, many, many chefs. And it's strange to see such a strong reaction from a pretty callous group of individuals. Really everybody kind of, he touched a lot of areas of our industry.
Mm-hmm. For sure.
I think also at a time when, you know, he was not the dean of a culinary school. He was not, you know, still in the kitchen running his own restaurant, but through the medium of television and his books, he, in a way, probably touched even more people who had culinary interests or who didn't know that they did. I mean, that's what I've been seeing a lot of outpouring, you know, on Twitter, on Instagram, on Facebook, people who never met him but who want to say something because behind closed doors or through reading a book, you know, he touched them in some way and made them feel like this was a world that they wanted to get into.
Mm-hmm. Well, originally he just wrote an article for The New Yorker and they published it and he was very surprised, and that's what became Kitchen Confidential, which that book really seemed to be what chefs appreciated, calling it a pirate ship down there. And I actually see a lot of parallels with that book in the movie Ratatouille, you know, really showing what each position was. And these are ex-criminals, some of them, you know, and they have burn marks all over their arms as a kind of source of pride and all that.
Well, he said it was one of the first cultures that he felt like he belonged in, where it felt familiar to him. You were allowed to go against the grain and to find yourself in a kitchen with all of these, you know, hardworking individuals that came from all different walks of life made sense to him.
Is that a tough group to wrangle as someone, before we introduce you officially and all that, was that a tough group for you to wrangle? 7 restaurants, chefs, and there are these weird personalities?
Yeah, I mean, there's a reason you find yourself in the kitchen, and it isn't, you know, your highly adept social skills usually. but yeah, it's an interesting environment. And some of the same things that he, you know, showed a spotlight on were the things that, you know, drew a lot of us to the kitchen. And it was a great, you know, honor to have somebody shed a light on that and make it cool and sexy.
Well, speaking of the kitchen, and that those words came from Daniel Sharp, our guest, our in-studio guest today. Daniel is an alum of some of our favorite Bay Area restaurants, including Chez Panisse and A16, a California native in 2011, I believe. Did I get that right?
Yeah.
Daniel moved to New York to become executive chef of the Meatball Shop. And since then, Daniel has helped to develop and grow the business to include 6 locations in New York and another soon-to-be-open location in Washington, D.C. So, Daniel, thanks for being with us today.
Glad to be here.
Our first question is, The Meatball Shop was really the first concept of its kind back in 2009, that being fast casual and the beginning of the wave of meatballs. Now there are many concepts like yours that have followed. How do you remain ahead of the game and current in a sea of copycats?
Well, you know, it's unsexy as it is. It's just like, a lot of work. funny thing about, you know, the meatball trend, and there's been a lot of, let's call them admirers, imitators. You know, I guess the one thing that's funny about that is a lot of them have come and go. So it does tell you that, like, it, while a good idea, it's not that good of an idea that you can just take it, copy it, and run with it. So, you know, it does also come down to, you know, we're trying to thread a needle between quality and price. And threading a needle is really what it comes down to, because you're always, those two things are always pitted against each other. So to try to do the best and serve the best quality food and ingredients you can, while doing it in a relaxed way that keeps it affordable for everybody, is a challenge, and that's kind of what we push for every day.
Did you make mistakes coming up with that concept? I mean, are there things that are ridiculous? I mean, one of the things you once told me is that you have all the chefs cooking in the restaurants. It's not like a franchise concept where they're just pushing buttons. Like,
yeah, it's very, you know, as we grow, you know, almost everybody who's grown as quickly as we do will tell you what a mistake growing is. You know, growing pains are growing pains. And being a multi-unit restaurant that still does scratch cooking is always a challenge. You know, I like to tell people we're the same, you know, basically the same formula and model as a steakhouse. You know, you have your proteins, you can choose sauces, you can choose sides. But when you, you know, when my cook cuts a piece, you know, at a steakhouse, when a prep cook cuts off a steak, they're getting $60, $70 for that. And, you know, rolling four meatballs in a bowl is $9. So, you know, it's it's everything. It's all the work that goes into those kind of into that environment, but, you know, at a much more affordable price.
Does the meatball shop serve healthy food, would you say? And can you talk about health and the sort of ups and downs of fad or trendy diets and how you adjust for those?
Yes. I'd love to talk about this. So I think health is a really broad, undefinable term, but ultimately I think health is, you know, a lot of what we've already talked about on this program, whereas what is healthy for us, what is healthy for the planet, what is sustainable. And, you know, I think that, you know, just to bring back the topic from before, but I think anything that is unbalanced is not healthy. And I think health is always a balance. It's not about none of this or no this, or, you know, it's all about, okay, this in moderation, well-rounded diets, and, you know, the freedom and ability to choose and be positive about your choices. We serve a variety of things that are not meat, beyond the meatballs and salads and vegetables. And so, you know, for the person who is conscious about what they're eating, we have an offering for that person. You can customize and make your meal what you want. And the quality of the ingredients have integrity, and they are, you know, cooked in our locations and from scratch. So, you know, I think that for me is health. I think the restrictive over, like, if I'm, you know, I look at these fad diets, and it's always like, you know, especially in this country, we're just so black and white about our dieting. It's like, okay, my diet cuts out all of this or all of that. And you're like, yeah, like, you probably shouldn't just eat cheese, but you don't have to eat no cheese. Like, there is a happy medium there. And, you know, I think historically, you know, if we're talking about diets, like, as soon as we got above the food chain, then we started to put, like, self, you know, restrictions on us. And what was healthy, you know, used to be, you know, spirituality and physical health used to be kind of intertwined. And a lot of what we eat and how we eat as people goes back to that, these ideas of, like, you know, it kind of defines us, and we have certain expectations for health. And, you know, most of the diets you see out there are very pseudoscience. You know, they're not really well researched, and you know, there aren't clinical studies that tell you, you know, with any certainty. So I think the one thing that it's constant, you're like, hey, moderation, balance, and just informed education of what you're eating too. I think that, you know, a lot of people get ideas in their heads about what we'd be eating, and they go like full force and don't really do the research of like, well, is this actually good for me, or am I just feeding into the buzzword of it?
Mm-hmm. It seems like also it's about education, as you said, because mm-hmm. I'm sure you have lots of options on your menu that might already fit the bill for paleo or gluten free. You can order your meatballs naked or not. You know, it's just about fitting in to understanding what the fad diets might be without changing your whole menu.
It's also about, you know, from the consumer point of view, it's funny because you know, people have like, they're like, oh, I am, you know, gluten free. But then they come in with the expectation that you're going to make everything on the menu gluten free. And you're like, okay, well, we have a bunch of options. We have a bunch, you can do a lot. But unfortunately, a lot of times the fad diet, it's like they want the entire world to conform to that, where it's like, okay, we have a gluten-free meatball, mm-hmm. But not all of our meatballs are gluten-free because bread is such an essential component of what makes a meatball, like asking us to take away that from everybody just doesn't seem like, it's not equitable. So it's like kind of like, hey, you know, but if that's what you want, like we have a lot of offerings. It's just not everything mm-hmm. is that.
Do you do fad diets, Brandon, personally, or
like have I ever participated in a fad diet? I actually don't think I've ever done a diet just in general. Uh-huh. I don't know if I've ever dieted uh-huh. ever. I just get fat and then I get skinny. I don't know how it happens. I would say it's probably stress related, both of them.
Yeah.
I get fat because I'm stressed out, and then I get super skinny because I'm stressed out.
Do you have that same thing? People are like gluten free.
I do. I agree. I think that the people's expectations are always like, I'm on this diet. Everything that's on this menu should conform to this diet that I'm on. And it's like I agree with the point. I think if you look through the menu, we obviously have a lot of options for you. But like I'm not gonna make a gluten free pizza. It's crazy hard for me. It's like a whole new facility I would have to build. I'd have to like separate all of our flours. Like to do it properly, it's really difficult. But there's plenty of options if you come to Roberta's to be gluten free. We love vegetables here. We have a large vegetable section, and so there's a lot of things that you can do with any kind of diet that you're on. So we're considerate in the process of making menus of like everybody's different kind of styles of eating, but also you just can't decide that you want to eat a certain way and then expect to go out to a place and then expect every single thing on a menu to be to you, because then that's like unfair to all of the other people who eat totally different ways as well.
Is there anything you say no to completely? You're just like some dietary trends out there and you're just like, nope. You have to get up and walk out of my restaurant because there's not one thing.
No, I mean, I don't think there's anything like that, unless it's something like, you know, so if somebody tells you they're allergic to salt, which you're like, no, that's not a thing. And there's salt in almost everything that we serve. Yeah.
Because David Chang, I think, once was like, there's meat in everything. Mm-hmm. We do not have a single vegetarian dish on.
No, I mean, I think, you know, part of what our concept was being very inclusive and having a pick and choose menu kind of was recognize a trend of where people want to customize. And I think what happened was people forgot how to cook. And now they go out to restaurants and you know how everybody here like opens the fridge and you have that one weird thing that you eat at home. And it's kind of, you know, you're like, oh, that's weird and kind of gross. I put those things together, but I like it. Now that's translated into the restaurant field where it's like, you would be embarrassed to ask the chef to like do this for you.
Peanut butter and nuts or what? Yeah,
whatever
about?
It is. You put peanut butter on your pickle late at night. And
what's
like,
your secret, like, Daniel? Yeah, what's your secret fridge item? No, I'm not simple.
But I think that people now, that is the new, you know, what's funny is like, that's the new way people kind of go out and they treat a restaurant like they treat their kitchen. Mm-hmm. So they want these weird, they want combinations of things, or they just want to eat how they want to eat. So we've never been about no, like, you know, like I said, we got options for everybody, but you can't do everything, can't fit everybody's mm-hmm. diets. And, you know, I think it's really important also for us, you know, get when you're talking about, you know, having gluten-free pizza and what that would undertake, it's also realizing that, like, hey, there's a big difference between, you know, making something gluten-free and people are actually celiac and allergic to something. So you don't want to like do that and promote that you have that, because then there is a small portion of the population that is susceptible to cross-contamination, and it's not just I don't eat this, but and being able to do it right is a big difference between you know, just making a simple offering of it.
So what's next for you at the Meatball Shop? You're going to DC?
Well, opening soon? And you guys are speaking on the panel together.
Next Thursday.
Yeah, we're gonna cut it up. I'm doing a little talk at MOFAD. We're gonna dive into what makes meatballs, and specifically focus on some of the meat aspect of it, and, you know,
so heritage breeds. And why, Emily, yeah, were you asked to be on the panel?
I was asked to talk about where Daniel, well, no, I'm interviewing you, but it's, yeah, so it's, there is a focus on where his sourcing comes from, where his meat comes from.
A ton of wheat.
Shamelessly always comes, yeah, back around to heritage.
It was
like yeah, every show revolves around what Patrick's doing. How do we get this back to Patrick?
Yeah, right away. No, heritage breeds. You guys buy a ton of heritage, mm-hmm, literally 2,000 pounds a week, and manage to keep your dishes to $9, $10.
Yeah,
bucks.
That's, yeah, crazy. It's so. Patrick's softball hitting batting cage, right?
Well, so anyone who wants to learn more about Daniel, yeah, and the Meatball Shop and sourcing, it's next Thursday, June 21st at the Museum of Food and Drink, MOFAD.
Yeah, come on by.
There will also be some samples, right?
Yeah, sample meatballs and sample meats.
When does DC open?
No confirmed date yet.
This year, though.
Oh, yeah, very. It's soon. You know, it's just we don't put it out there until we're actually sure that we're going to make that target.
You got to have the Rodman ball,
you know.
Fair enough.
And find the worm in the Rodman ball. No, that's going to be good, man. DC, that's the center,
yeah,
of the
world.
Yeah,
we're opening this summer in DC, and it's really exciting for us to be out of New York for the first time and exploring a new market. It's really fun. It feels like a lot of the energy of when we first opened, because we're new. Everybody's really been super welcoming in DC, and I've been making trips down there to meet with some of our purveyors and local partners down there and meet some people. So it's been really positive. Really,
I think they're about ready for a revolution down there.
Yeah. And Brandon's opening in L.A. There's a Roberta's in L.A.
Who said that? I didn't know that was happening.
When's that,
oh, really?
Happening?
Is that not official? Oh. So something's happening.
It's the first I've heard of it.
So anyway, there's some big news happening in the restaurant world. So
for sure. Anyway, that's it for today. An extra special thank you to our guests, Daniel Sharp and Frank Reese. Thanks for being with us, everyone. And for those of you listening live, make sure to stick around for Tech Bites at 11.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at @heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening. Modern design, black convertible top, and the gals don't mind. Sporting with me riding all around town.